It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, spending on pets increased by nearly 400% between 1998 and 2018. A new book digs into America's growing pet culture and how it's changed the world we live in. First, as humans, we know we have an impact on our environment, the plants, animals, even the atmosphere around us. This has been going on, though, for a very long time. About as long as humans have been evolving, we've been changing the evolutionary paths of our planet's co-inhabitants. Sometimes that's been intentional, sometimes not. Now we have a lot of high-tech tools that can speed up the process, including different gene editing technologies. Our next guest says we can learn lessons from human history and prehistory to make the best use of those technologies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of the use of genetic modification technology? How about to keep a species from going extinct? How about to use it to clean up or even prevent pollution? Call in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Beth Shapiro is a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's the author of the book, How to Clone a Mammoth. Her latest book out today is called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Your book looks at modern biotechnology through the lens of, like I said, 50,000 years or so of human modification of the environment. What led you to look toward lessons from the past for these big decisions we face right now?
Well, you know, my research is in a field called ancient DNA. I work out in the Arctic mostly because that's where DNA preserves better, collecting bones and teeth and hair and stuff like that from plants and animals that used to be alive. And my goal with my research is to understand what made some species or populations more resilient in the face of past periods of rapid climate change, like warming after the last ice age or the first introduction of humans. And what we've learned over the decades of studying ancient DNA is about the tremendous impact that people have had on the plants and animals with which we share this planet. And today, you know, we're facing these enormous decisions that we have to make about how far we are willing to go using our new technologies to try to protect the species and spaces that we appreciate and know around us. And it's useful, I think, to look into the past to understand better how it is that we've been manipulating species for a long time. It helps to think that, to realize that we aren't suddenly moving into the role of manipulating or messing with or really causing species to evolve in a particular way, but have been in this role for some time.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of humans as an evolutionary shaper of the world around us?
Yeah, so in the book, I kind of divided it up into technological periods. So the first evidence that people were really messing with the evolution of other species comes from the fossil records of the continents around the world, where as soon as people start moving out of Africa and into other parts of the world, we see evidence that they are hunting species. Species are becoming extinct. We're changing the landscape, and that's reducing habitat available for species. And this, of course, was not intentional. We didn't turn up. Our ancestors didn't turn up in a place plan to drive species extinct, but it was a consequence of how we were changing the landscape when people got there. And then somewhere around 10 to 15,000 years ago, it changed or began to change. And this is really the beginning of the, they call it the Neolithic, or the period where you start seeing domestication and agriculture. People realized that the driving species or populations extinct was not an inevitable consequence of finding enough food to keep their families fed, and began to try out different strategies, like not taking animals that were reproductive, taking only males or older females, leaving the females that could reproduce in the population so that that population would survive. And then, of course, the animals that they were hunting came closer. They were brought closer to human settlements. And this was the beginning of herding technology. And through this, we started to learn about animal behavior and reproductive cycles and really becoming herders and hunters, herders and caretakers rather than just hunters. And that went on for some time. And we succeeded because of our success in agriculture and farming and in becoming proficient at keeping things like cattle and goats, etc. And there became a lot of us. And all of our animals and plants started taking over all of the wild spaces. And then somewhere between 100 and 200 years ago, we went through yet another technological transformation where we moved from being herders and hunters and farmers to realizing that if we really want to see other species on this planet, we're actually going to have to become caretakers. And this was the early part of the conservation movement. Now, a lot of people think of conservation as leaving things alone. Let's stand back and let the earth be just fine. But in fact, what conservation is us deciding who gets to survive, who gets to reproduce, where different plants and animals get to live. And as we transitioned to caretakers, to protectors, we took over the evolutionary trajectories of everything that we interact with, not just those species that we consider our domesticates. So it's really been a change. We've gone through several different technological innovations in this time.
Talking to Beth Shapiro, her new book is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, Beth, a big new toolkit now with genetic modification technology, which covers a lot of different technologies, I know. I think people might look at this and say, okay, yeah, we bred animals or we selectively killed this animal, not that one. Slow changes that took generations to make. Biotechnology feels a little different. We can tweak a gene and have it in the wild by next year. Is there something qualitatively different that should make us think of biotechnology in a different way than all the stuff we've been doing for tens of thousands of years?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it would be unfair to say that there isn't something different about what we're doing now. But we also have to think about the potential benefits and where we've been. I mean, a lot of people are nervous about using gene editing to help to change things that we eat, for example. We can go in and we can tweak a gene and we can make papayas resistant to ring spot virus, which are papaya virus, we're killing the papayas in Hawaii, for example. Or we can tweak a gene and turn something up and down that makes something taste a little bit better. This technology is kind of scary because if we don't really understand it, because we're going in and we're trying to mess with stuff and maybe there's some unintended consequences. What people often don't remember is that the plants and animals that we have today are not just the consequence of very careful selective breeding, but we do things, for example, called radiation breeding, where we'll stick a whole bunch of baby plants into an environment where we just zap them with radioactivity or with chemical mutagens and cause tens of thousands of mutations. And we get things like ruby red grapefruits and renin wheats. These are all products that we're not scared of because they're not genetically modified in any way, but they are products that we have caused tens of thousands of uncharacterized mutations to occur and just pick the ones that we like. So we are doing crazy stuff that isn't genetic editing or genetic engineering that, you know, I mean, there's nothing inherently scary about mutations. That's not why I'm bringing this up, mm-hmm. but it's strange to be worried about going in and making one very specific mutation like we can do with gene editing, but not worrying so much about making 10,000 mutations in mutation breeding and ending up with delicious ruby red grapefruits.
Last time you joined us, we talked about the idea of de-extinction, bringing back, say, a mammoth. And you were more excited, I think, about the idea of using these kind of technologies to prevent extinction. So I want to dig into one case study that's close to my heart, the black-footed ferret, which was really close to extinct, about as close as you can get to being extinct without being extinct. Can you talk a little bit about the black-footed ferret story and where some genetic interventions could make a big difference?
Yeah, this is a great story and one of my favorites. So, you know, black-footed ferrets, they're this little predator that lives across the plains, and they eat prairie dogs. And during the early and middle part of the 20th century, there was this massive prairie dog eradication program because they're nuisances. You know, they can break down roads and infrastructures, and they get in the way of farms. And the successful prairie dog eradication program also was pretty successful at eradicating black-footed ferrets. In fact, black-footed ferrets were one of the original species listed when the Endangered Species Act first came into being. And I think it was the middle of the 80s. They captured the last living black-footed ferrets and put them into captivity and had really very little luck having successfully breeding them in captivity. And they thought they were extinct until a black-footed ferret was discovered near Meteetse, Wyoming. And this was amazing to everyone because they thought this whole species was extinct. And here it was, another opportunity to see if they could figure out how to do captive breeding for the black-footed ferret. So they brought these animals in, and everything looked pretty good for a while. They were finding healthy ferrets in the wild. And then suddenly, they weren't finding any more healthy ferrets. They were only finding sick or dead ferrets. And in a last-ditch effort, they brought as many individuals into captivity as they could and tried to breed them. They had success finally when they got one individual whose name was Scarface. And he was the first male to actually breed any of the females in captivity. And this captive breeding program has been a tremendous success. Black-footed ferrets are released into the wild every year, and those populations are a little bit successful, but there's still one really terrible thing that happens, and that is that black-footed ferrets, when they're released into the wild, they will catch and kill and eat a prairie dog, and that prairie dog is often infected by introduced Sylvatic plague, and these black-footed ferrets get plague, and they die. And so there are a couple of options that people have been looking into to try to help black-footed ferrets to survive using the tools of new modern biotechnologies. And the first is that there's a place in San Diego called the Frozen Zoo where there are tissue samples from black-footed ferrets that lived prior to this first near extinction that were part of this first captive breeding trial program that didn't work. And about a year ago, Revive and Restore, which is a nonprofit out of Sausalito, California, partnered with the San Diego Frozen Zoo and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to start a program to see if they could clone animals from those frozen tissue specimens that are in the San Diego Frozen Zoo. And a few months ago, an individual, a little girl, black-footed ferret kit called Elizabeth Ann was born. And Elizabeth Ann's, her DNA, her genetics show that she is distantly related to all of the individuals that are in the captive breeding program. And she, as soon as she is old enough, will be entered into this captive breeding program and will make an eighth founder individual. Eight founder individuals for the entire living population of black-footed ferrets. So she, her DNA will be a welcome bit of diversity into this population. But it might not necessarily solve the problem of Sylvatic plague. And for that, they're looking elsewhere. So the cousin of the black-footed ferret, the domestic ferret, evolved with Sylvatic plague and is naturally immune to it. So this partnership, again, between Revive and Restore, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and several other academic institutions in the San Diego Zoo, are now working to figure out why it is genetically that domestic ferrets can't get plague or don't get sick when they get plague. And once they've discovered that, their plan is to use genetic engineering to introduce that bit of domestic ferret DNA into black-footed ferrets, essentially creating an animal that is 99.999% black-footed ferret and 0.000% some number of zeros, 1% domestic ferret, but that is not able to get plague. And this is an amazing example to me of how these new technologies, including genetic modification and gene editing, could be used to help species to adapt to today's environment, where evolution, natural selection, isn't going to be enough for these animals to survive. But we can help them using these tools.
We're talking to Beth Shapiro, professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book out today is Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Evolution Refined and Redefined Nature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of using these kind of genetic tools to modify animals to save them from extinction, as we were just hearing about the black-footed ferret there? Do you have questions about this work, how this works, concerns about it? How about genetic modification to fight pollution, to create mosquitoes that die out on their own or maybe don't spread diseases like malaria? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Beth Shapiro from the University of California, Santa Cruz, talking about her new book out today. It's called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature. Beth, with genetic modification for whatever purpose, preventing extinction, boosting food crop output, whatever the case may be, I think people worry about unintended consequences. At the macro level, we've introduced species to continents where they've been pretty devastating in the past. How do we address concerns about the things we introduce, the things we tweak and modify running amok once they get out into the wild?
It's a really good question, and it's an important thing to think about whenever we think about introducing invasive species. We do, as a species, have a long history of doing stuff like this, releasing a new species, imagining that there's going to be a solution to a problem by introducing an invasive species and then it going amok, as you say. We also have a long history of driving things to extinction by overhunting them or coming up with other solutions. I think what's going to be most important is that we really engage in careful consideration of the possible risks. You know, we can't just make a decision somewhere that impacts the rest of the world. We have to start having these conversations all at once with all possible stakeholders. And, you know, it isn't really possible to do much of this stuff just yet, which is why it's important to start having these conversations now. You know, gene drives, this idea that we can pass a trait, you mentioned resistance to malaria in mosquitoes, through an entire population. One of the ways that this is being imagined is that they would introduce a trait that actually makes the mosquitoes unable to reproduce, right? So they're essentially trying to drive the mosquito population all the way down to zero. But there's also a very long conversation about how you would do this and include what they're calling a kill switch, or a way to stop this from happening. And essentially, that would be, you know, you would edit the genomes that it contains, the letters that code for this particular trait, but also letters that you could turn on that stop that trait from happening. Or there's another situation where you put these gene drives in, but you attach them to other drives, and only one of them, and the one at the very end, this is kind of confusing to think about. They call it a daisy chain drive. So what you have is multiple different driving elements in the genome, but one of them doesn't get passed on. And the end consequence of all of this is that the trait that makes half of the individuals that are born not survive only lasts for a fixed number of generations, say 10 generations. So over time, fewer and fewer individuals have that trait. And then hopefully it's been a strong enough drive that the population collapses, but it doesn't stand any chance at all of persisting forever. So it's these kinds of things, kill switches and genetic changes that can't persist forever in the natural population, that people are thinking about when we're considering using these kind of tools for conservation.
A big question is who decides? I can imagine if I'm in one country in a malaria zone, I might make one decision about the mosquitoes. The neighbors across the border might make a different one, and the mosquitoes don't care about the borders. You give a smaller case in your book looking out Lyme disease resistant mice and bringing together different communities on the East Coast. How are they considering how to decide whether or not to try to fight Lyme disease with genetically modified mice?
So this is a program called Mice Against Ticks. It's led by a professor at MIT, Kevin Esfeld, and he is one of the leading speakers who's really reading thinkers about how we should be able to use gene drive technologies. So the idea here is that people who live on Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and other islands and along in the Northeast, there's a really high incidence of Lyme disease, which is debilitating disease. And so nobody wants to get this. And mice are the reservoirs for Lyme disease. So it comes, ticks bite the mice, the ticks bite the people get Lyme disease, the mice are carriers. What they would like to do is engineer mice so that they can't carry Lyme disease, that they're resistant to it in some way. And in this way, they won't be able to reinfect the ticks, and the ticks won't be infected, and then people won't be infected. But Kevin and Mice Against Ticks are adamant that the only way that you could use this sort of technology is if you have buy-in from the local communities. And so he has built these consortiums of people who live on the islands, who he is working with so that they can really understand the short-term and long-term and potential consequences of these technologies. And then they are choosing. And so far, they have chosen that they don't want to use gene drives, but they do want to do something about Lyme disease. And so they're still all working together to figure out what the best solution for them is. And I think this is a great example of how scientists and stakeholders can work together. Kevin clearly feels that gene drives have strong potential to be helpful here, but he also understands that you can't just impose your will on a community, and that an action in one place is going to also have consequences to other locations. And this is the challenge that we're going to face as we start to think about these technologies. But as I said before, you know, these technologies exist. They will become increasingly powerful, and people will decide eventually that they're going to use them, whether they have global permission or stakeholder buy-in or not. So now is the time for those of us who really believe that there needs to be stakeholder buy-in to start having these conversations so that everybody can understand the technology and can invest in making decisions about what is going to impact them and their children and their communities.
In just our last minute or so, Beth, it seems like the core message of your book isn't even so much about the technology available, but the idea of responsibility. Can you talk about, given how much humans have changed the animal world, the plant world for that matter, make the case that we have some responsibility not just to step away when things go bad?
Well, you know, what I worry about the most is we all imagine, when you think about conservation, that we either have the choice to stand back and let nature heal on its own, to leave it alone, or to jump in and get our hands dirty. The problem is that it is too late for us to imagine that we can stand back. The pace of change today, the pace of extinction today, is way faster than what evolution by natural selection can keep up with. And this is because of us, because of the impact that we have had on habitats and species around the world. If we want to live in a world that is both biodiverse and full of humans, we're going to have to figure out how to take advantage of these technologies that allow us to meddle with species at a pace that keeps up with the changes that we are imposing on the landscapes around us.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you. It was fun.
That's Beth Shapiro, professor of evolutionary biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. We talked to her about her new book just out today. It's called Life as We Made It, How 50,000 Years of Human Innovation Refined and Redefined Nature.